Okay, so for those who were here last time, and for those who were not, you may or may not remember, last time we were discussing the Jewish approach to Islam. So I think it's already 2 weeks, because we took a little Shavuot break. So just to catch everyone up, so we spent the week before that discussing Jewish views of Christianity, and we're now ready to segue to, then we had segued to the beginnings, at least, of our discussion of Judaism and Islam. And we said that if we are asking a core theological question, if we want to know fundamentally how does Judaism view the essential faith commitment, the essential theology of Islam, it would seem to be a relative no-brainer. Obviously, it goes without saying that there are fundamental and essential differences between Judaism and Islam. It goes without saying, whether with regard to, God bless, to with regard to the prophecy of Moshe as the great final prophet versus, of course, that of Muhammad, whether it be in terms of scripture, the status of what we consider to be Tanakh versus the status of the Quran, similar distinctions with Christianity. But of course, in terms of the basic concept of monotheism, Islam is much closer to Judaism, and in a sense even more extreme, even more pure in terms of its opposition to icons and the like, then is Christianity. Christianity, we can ask about the Trinity. Is it three? Is it one? Is it considered idolatrous? Is it not considered idolatrous? And Islam seems to be relatively straightforward to the point that we open with the discussion of the permissibility of davening in a mosque. Clearly, there are serious halachic questions to be raised and potential halachic objections to entering a church, never mind davening in a church. But what about entering or davening in a mosque? It might seem very awkward, very unusual, especially given the state of the world today. But from a pure halachic perspective, leaving aside politics and even critical and important points of disagreement, what's the halacha? So we saw that there was a story in which someone posted very prominently that he went into a mosque and claimed that Rav Ovadia Yosef Paskins, that actually if a person has a choice between davening in Stama place, any place, versus davening in a mosque, not only is it permissible to pray in a mosque, it is in fact preferred. It's better to daven in a mosque. So we said, and the Facebook commentators came in and they said as well, they swooped in and said two things. Number one, yes, permissibility of davening in a mosque, absolutely, that is what Rav Avad Yosef says in the Tshuva. Reference to praying in a mosque that we haven't seen. So again, the jury's still out. It might be out there. There's a Tshuva from Rav Avadia that I haven't seen, that others haven't seen. But nonetheless, the fundamental notion you can pray in a mosque seems awkward, but it happens actually not irregularly in places like Ma'arat al-Khrila, something that is done. It might seem unusual to us, but on a pure halachic level, we said there really is such an argument to me. And indeed, we surveyed a whole host of views, as sort of our first section, that maintain that while Christianity might well constitute idolatry, as we discussed previously, that Islam is considered to be pure monotheism. This is the view of the Rambam. The Rambam lived in an Islamic milieu, the Rambam Paskin, that Islam is considered to be, again, terribly objectionable. He had rather harsh and colorful things to say about Muhammad. He called him a mishuga, did not have kind things to say about him at all. So this is not the Rambam, the way of saying the Rambam was some great pluralist, but in terms of the question of idolatry, there the Rambam was very clear. He said that there are laws, God bless, there are laws that govern Gentile wine. Nonetheless, there are differences between Gentile wine and idolater's wine. Gentiles' wine are only prohibited from drinking, and idolaters' wine is considered to be prohibited even from deriving benefit. I can't sell it, engage in commercial transactions with it, and so on and so forth. You know, when we talk about chametz, we talk about feeding it to your dog. That's always a classic example of deriving benefit without eating something directly. I don't know too many dog owners who serve wine to the dog, so I haven't seen that issue raised. I know some people who are thinking about it, or coming to the point, either the dogs or they will be drinking soon, but this I haven't seen. Anyhow, that's the Rambam's psak. I give that to you in source 2 here, in Ilchot Ma'achalot Asor Perek Aleph Halacha Zayin. And despite the fact that, again, he castigates Muhammad in terms of at least the the objectionability from a Jewish perspective of certain core principles of Jewish faith, nonetheless, not only does he consider them to be Gentiles but not idolaters vis-a-vis their wine, but in source 4 we cited his letter on apostasy, Gered Hashmad. The Rambam writes this as a relatively young man. The Rambam is born, there's a scholarly dispute, he's born in 1135, he's born in 1138, around that time. And this is written in approximately 1160 or 1161. So the Rambam, in other words, is writing at the age of, right, of 22 or 25. He's a young man. And he writes a brilliant, extensive letter to the community, which is struggling tremendously. The temptation of conversion to Islam at this time was extremely significant. The rewards, quite frankly, in terms of either survival at certain times, in terms of economic opportunities that were available, were just dramatic. They were through the roof, and there were many incentives for Jews to convert to Islam, and there were many who did convert to Islam. In fact, the Rambam's antagonists at later points in his life actually went so far as to accuse him and his family of having converted to Islam under the threat of martyrdom. It's an accusation I was told. There's no real evidence for that, but there's clear evidence that that was plausible enough that that accusation could be thrown at you and might even stick. That was the kind of context we're talking about. The Rambam writes this letter. It's a beautiful, uplifting, comforting letter to the people of North Africa, communities such as Fez in Morocco, which is a major Jewish center at that time, Kairouan, which was in modern-day Tunisia, and where some other rabbis and community members lived. And the Rambam basically writes that if someone is given a choice between martyrdom on the one hand and conversion to Islam on the other, the Rambam writes, number one, one has the option of martyrdom. Not everyone agrees that you have an option to give up your life in certain cases. Others say, either you do or you don't. The notion that I can choose whether or not to become a martyr, to give up my life, halachically is controversial, but that's assumption number one. And number two, the Rambam says, if a person chooses to convert to Islam, at least temporarily, with their heart still set fundamentally on Judaism, we do not castigate that individual. They're not considered to be someone who is outside the Jewish community. It's unlike Christianity. The Rambam gave a very different answer with regard to Christianity, or he would have. It's very clear, because he thought it's purely idolatrous. The Rambam, however, wasn't living in a Christian context. There were a handful of Christians living in Egypt later on in his life. But basically, he grew up and lived all of his life in an Islamic context. The Rambam says martyrdom does not consider someone to be outside the faith. And that's part of this larger view that Islam is considered to be monotheistic. And this really is the overwhelming majority of opinion. If you take a look on page 4, you see Rav Shlomo ben Aderet, the Rashba, he maintains similarly to the Rambam, he writes that Ger Toshav, Eino Osir Yain v'Maga'o, resident alien, so a Gentile who has accepted the 7 Noahide laws, and such an individual does not prohibit wine upon touching it. V'chein Yino Mutar Bahanan. Similarly, his wine is considered to be permitted in deriving benefit. On this basis, the Geonim, so this is the period prior to the Rishonim, from about 800 to 1100 in areas, basically it was ancient Babylonia, places like Baghdad and like modern day Iraq, that area. So the rabbis who were influential at that time. That if they touch the wine, it's true that we can't drink it, but we can derive benefit because they're not idolaters. Again, Sharei Einam Ovdei Avodah Zarah. They're not idol worshippers. This again is representative of the majority view during the Middle Ages. And then I gave you Shulchan Aruch. Same halachic ruling, the Shulchan Aruch. Again, Rav Yosef Karo. Where is he from? Anyone know his background? He famously lives toward the end of his life in Sfat. Good. But where is he coming? Well, he lives ultimately in Sfat, but where is he coming from? Anyone know? His family, what? His family was a Spanish family. His family fled during the expulsion in 1492. I believe they made their way to Constantinople and then ultimately to the north of Israel, to Tzfat. So he's also coming from that kind of background. Any Gentile who does not worship idols, his wine is considered to be prohibited again in drinking, but mutar bahana, but one is permitted to derive benefit. To whom does he refer? The Magen Avraham, the Taz, a later commentator, but based, I think this is reflecting the simple reading of the Shulchan Aruch as well. Sheino ovid elilim kigon, such as Hayishmeilim, the same position the Ishmaelites as well, the same kind of thing. And then I give you at the bottom here the tshuva, just a snippet from the tshuva of Rav Avadya that I know about this issue. Rav Avadya, by the way, of course, was not only a Sephardi, but he grew up, at least as a very young man, in Egypt. He grew up in Egypt, like the Rambam lived for the latter half of his life. I believe he was 4 when his family made Aliyah. It's actually an interesting snippet that I learned about Rav Avadya, that his name was Ovadya Yosef, and then his family took on the last name, Yosef. So technically, his name was Ovadya Yosef. Yosef. Now, if you were growing up, you might well say, that's not going to work out very well for social reasons. So he or his family or whatever shortened it, and so he became Rav Ovadya Yosef. But now we know the real, the full name, what the birth certificate said, as it were. So Rav Ovadya, who was initially Egyptian, and then he went back as a Dayan, actually, to Egypt for some time. He got into, I mentioned, I think in some previous class, maybe, about Rav Soloveitchik's arguments when he was in Boston with the Shochtem and the Kashrus Agency. I mentioned that at some point earlier this year, perhaps. Rav Ovadya, Rav Soloveitchik was far from the only one who had these kinds of struggles. You have a rabbi who knows the laws of Kashrut, who tries to change an entrenched industry with significant financial implications for the Shochtem. They have their own investments in this, and then the community can become complicated. Rav Avadya actually goes back and becomes a Rav in Egypt for some time, I think back to Cairo, and runs into some of those challenges, ultimately comes back to Israel and becomes a famed Rav Avadya Yosef. But he also was coming from a Sephardic background, and he insists that it was traditional and that it was accepted to daven in a mosque. He says it quite clearly. So he says, for example, he cites Rav Yitzchak Elchanan. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan's specter, this is a very Ashkenazic posik. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan was also, for those who are familiar, Yeshiva University's Yeshiva branch, right? Reitz, right, stands for, that's the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. That's after this Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, who was a great posik. One of his great claims to fame was the lengths that he would go to permit agunot. That was one of the great legacies of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, and for that and a host of other reasons, he became the namesake of extension of Yeshiva University. I once heard a very beautiful lecture from Dr. Norman Lamb about this, very, very moving, about all the efforts that Rav Yitzchak Elchanan undertook to try to advocate and make a difference in that area, and he really did. Shubansati lagon Rav Yitzchak Elchanan v'shut in Yitzchak, so Rav Avadya Yosef, that I later found confirmation for my view about the permissibility of praying in a mosque from the responsum of Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, Shenishal Odot Anshei Tzava Yehudim, who was asked with regard to Jewish soldiers, maybe the Russian army or something like that, I'm not sure exactly the details. Shenishal Odot Anshei Tzava Yehudim, they definitely were not Tzahal, because he died well before the founding of the State of Israel.
If you don't mean, what? He was doing World War II when they were in North Africa.
He was, but he was still, I think he passed before World War II, I'm pretty sure. I think when they named the institution after him, I think he had already passed, and that was already a good 100 years ago, if not more. So he's really an earlier posik. So he was asked with regard to Jewish soldiers, shebikshu me'it hasar, right? So they asked from the sar, from their officer, latet lahem makon kedei leitbala. They asked for permission to have a place for prayer. He said, there, go to the mosque. That's the place of prayer. You can daven there. Now, whether he did it as a lachis, to shtach them, as it were, or no, it was genuine, right? This is a place of prayer. You should go. You have this, by the way, you have these questions now that come up about interfaith chapels. And these are not uncommon. In fact, Rav Soloveitchik, he was asked with regard to the construction of an interfaith chapel at Cornell. Mm-hmm. At Cornell in maybe the 50s, something like that. And the 60s. And they reproduced this letter of his in a collection that I have, I think, over there somewhere on my bookshelf. And Rav Soloveitchik was actually asked specifically about the permissibility of the paintings of what the stained glass windows could contain, angels and human forms and animal forms and all these kinds of things. They said, "Dear Rabbi, we're planning to build an interfaith mosque." Basically, they said, whether you like, excuse me, an interfaith place of prayer, a mosque, a church, and synagogue, all three. Excuse me. We're planning to go ahead with the project. Mm-hmm. Our donor came forward. It's a done deal. That's not the question we're asking you, Rabbi. We just want to know, once we're going ahead with this, what does Jewish law have to say about all this? So Rabbi Soloveitchik says, "I'm sorry they didn't ask me about the interfaith chapel ahead of time, but now that you asked me about this, I have to go back to step one and tell you my frank opinion about the interfaith chapel." They clearly knew what his opinion was. I presume they knew, and they weren't interested in hearing. And he actually expresses a strong opposition. He says that in his opinion, it is offensive not just to the Jewish faith, the concept of an interfaith chapel, but to Islam and Christianity as well, that it is to water down the significance of the theological and fundamental points of distinction and dispute between the faith communities to simply say, oh, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish houses of prayer, they can all be the same thing. He claims, for example, that Christian and Jewish houses of prayer have very different philosophies and theology, that the church is generally speaking built with an eye toward a sense of looking upward, looking out of this world that's meant to be ethereal, it's otherworldly, it's almost mystical in that way, and that a synagogue is quite the opposite. We're not trying to exit this world and ascend to the area of the angels, we're trying to take the divine world and bring it down here onto earth. That was Soloveitchik's whole philosophy about the purpose of halachic practice. It's not that we're trying to leave this world, that was the view of the mystics, but the halachist desires to take sanctity and to bring it right here into our everyday lives, and to take this table and this recorder and our water bottles and everything around us and to elevate them, or to give them a sense of being filled with the halachic values and the halachic inspiration that is meant to be represented by the halachic system. So he said these are incommensurate, these are irreconcilable categories of worship, philosophies of worship, and therefore it is to undermine the basic tenets of each faith to try to put them in one. So the question of an interfaith prayer space is an interesting one. This came up for me in a practical context, because when I was at Einstein previously,
had
students who would be at a chapel. And the question was, so according to this view of Rabbi Soloveitchik, would that be problematic? And to many, and I consulted and I considered, and I think that there is a fundamental difference between building a prayer space that by design is meant to be a combination of the theologies, as it were, of different faith communities. And look, we're a hospital. We respect the value of prayer. We're creating a power space, and anyone who wants to come and pray can come in. Right? That's a different kind of thing. Now, it's sensitive because inside the drawer there are crosses, and underneath there are rugs for the Muslims to kneel and to pray. And by the way, we used to do that too. Right? They got that from the Beit HaMikdash. And during the Middle Ages, in Sephardic context, in Arabic context, Jews would often bow in prayer as well. We've lost this. But in Arabic countries, actually, first of all, these things that we're sitting on,
they
didn't have chairs. You walked into shul, you think you had a chair in 14th century in Cairo or something like that? Nonsense, right? You walk in and it was an empty space. And what you would do is you were saying tachanun. And you were saying tachanun, you know, like we do this thing? That's a paltry replacement for what Tachanun used to be. Tachanun was prostration.
Yeah.
Tachanun was like Aleinu on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. I mean, that's, we went full out. Like during the Avodah, when everyone prostrates. That's what it was. So actually, it was quite common for people to bow. So you have a combination. I don't think that a part of prayer space that's available as a chapel and a hospital is the same thing as an intentionally designed multi-faith prayer space, but that's already an aside. Anyhow, so they wanted to pray in essentially the opportunities made available to create a multi-faith prayer space in the mosque, essentially. And that was what was made available to them. Ha'ibu tar lehem leitbal al-sham. Was it permissible to pray there? Be'yishiv and Rav Yitzchak al-Chanan responded, says Rav Avadya, Shahuil Mavawar Batur, the Shem Hageonim, the same Gonim that we saw cited. Viha Rambam, Viha Rashba, in other words, a number of the sources that we already saw, who all maintain Shayish Me'ilim Einam Ovdei Avodah Zarah, that Ishmaelites are not considered to be idolatrous. V'chein Katav HaRama, and the Rama elsewhere, I didn't give it to you, but Rav Moshe Israel, the great Ashkenazic posek, rules accordingly. Yesh Latir Bifshitut. if she to it. It is a simple matter that one is permitted with Baal Hashem to pray there. So we see a number already of ramifications. We've seen three major ramifications of this first school of thought, which I think is the simplest school of thought, that Islam is just simply not idolatrous. Number one, with regard to the status of their wine. Number two, with regard to the very weighty question of martyrdom. With number three, with regard to the question of prayer in such a space, and that there are potentially a significant number of additional practical ramifications that would emerge.
How welcome would a Jew be to daven in a mosque?
Yes, this is a question that was asked in the 19th century. Things have changed, Emily.
No, but even so there were certain periods I know that
even in modern day Israel, there were different tkufot with regard to Har HaBayit and the like, and other places, and other things have really changed since the earlier years.
But I meant there was a time when it would have been okay that Jew would go in a corner and daven, or that a group would have a minion in the corner in a mosque and daven.
I don't know. That would be interesting to study historically. I don't know of any regular prayers. Minyanim that met in a mosque
ad hoc.
It would depend on the milieu, again, as you say. The Rambam, there's some dispute as to the historicity of the letter, but the Rambam seems to describe that he actually went up on Har HaBayit and prayed. And this becomes part of the disputes about going up to Har HaBayit and the like. It was it was different. It was a little bit different. It was crusader control, really. That's a different situation, but you have some. Okay. Now, there is, on the other hand, a curious, if minority, stream of thought in Jewish writing, in halachic writing, that seems to view Islam, actually, as somewhat idolatrous in this way. And the question is, what does that mean, and how could that be? But first, let me present you with some of the sources. So one perhaps leading source, and we'll see why this will become even more significant a little bit later on, is from the Ritva. This is source 10 on the top of page 5. The Ritva, Rabbeinu Yom Tov Ashbeli, just to situate him, we're talking about Barcelona in the 13th century. Barcelona in the 13th century. This is in a Christian context, the Ritva is writing. So he's one of the classical Talmudic commentators that we learn pretty regularly. You learn the Gemara Be'in, you're learning it in depth, you learn the Ritva classically. That's a pretty common kind of thing to do. So the Ritva writes his commentary to Rosh Hashanah, V'ilu ha-notzrim v'yish me'ilim. These Christians, we cited this for the Christianity comments in the previous shiur, these Christians, v'ha-yish me'ilim, v'chlal ninim he. Are considered to fall under the category of heretics. Uchumoshe Pirish Rashi, as Rashi himself had already said, Haminim, the heretics, Talmide Yeshu HaNotzri, that those include the students of Jesus the Nazarene. But he includes not just the Notzrim, but also the Ishmaelites, the Muslims, as well. Now, some have said, you see from here, that there is a core theological objection to Islam, and that maybe its status as monotheist should be brought under question. Anyone want to push back, though? Is there another reading here that would not render it as anything but monotheistic?
Well, is it fair to say that the Ishmaelim followed Jesus?
No, he doesn't mean that. He means two separate groups. He means the Christians who follow Jesus and the Ishmaelites, the Muslims who follow Muhammad.
But I mean, in terms of what Rashi says, students of Jesus.
Right, I don't think he means to include the Ishmaelim there. He's just giving an instance. I think he means other faith communities, such as, etc. Right, but it is a little confusing. I agree.
So what's your question?
So my question is there a difference maybe? Can the Ritva still maintain Islam's monotheism while still calling them heretics? Would the Rambam have called the Muslim a heretic? Is that heresy for the Rambam? So do I have an option as a Jew, according to the Rambam? So it's not heresy. Can I just go and believe in Islam and no one will have an objection? We don't like that so much, but no problem. Go for it. It's not heresy. Really?
Why would it be heresy if Muhammad is only a prophet?
Okay, how do we know what the Rambam's criteria for heresy are? What would the Rambam call a heretic? Clearly it's not a Avodah Zarah for him.
Right.
That's true. Emily, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Jerry.
No, that's all. I thought idolatry was the yardstick to determine whether they're heretic or not.
That's a yardstick for sure. Are there more for the Rambam?
I thought that heresy is when you start out with the original principles and then change them. Mohammed already was beyond, he didn't see himself as an offshoot of Judaism, even if he accepted the, maybe I'm wrong.
Right, well, that's a very important question, I think, about the relation between Judaism and Islam, as it is a parallel question with regard to Judaism and Christianity, for sure. But I think we can answer this question, even leaving that conceptual question aside. How many principles of faith does the Rambam have?
13.
Ah, the Rambam, for the Rambam, I think it's fair to assume that the 13 principles of faith are the determinant, right, the determinant to figure out whether or not someone is a heretic. Heresy is not the same as monotheism. I'll tell you how I know. What do the Rambam's principles of faith include? The Rambam, for example, number 6 is belief in prophecy. Number 7 is the belief that the greatest of prophets is
Moshe,
which many understand is very intentional, is polemical, right? Even if you don't understand it's polemical, the point remains. Not the greatest prophet and final prophet was Moses and not Muhammad and not Jesus, for that matter, right? Also, the 8th principle, go in order, is that the Torah is binding and will be forever, eternally so. That's a response, again, to both Christianity and Islam. So the Rambam, already 2 counts, and we can add more to this, but you get the point. Clearly for the Rambam, Islam is heresy. Even as the Rambam clearly also says that Islam is
monotheistic.
So those are not the same. It's very clear for the Rambam, and conceptually I think it's a really important distinction. If I chose as a Jew to become a Muslim, the Rambam would be horrified. He would say that I forego my share in the world to come, because the 13 principles of faith are sine qua non for the Rambam for receiving a share in Olam Haba. That's clear. Am I a monotheist? I am a monotheist. I'm a heretical monotheist. My monotheism is not the source of my heresy. I'm not Novid Avodah Zarah. That's clear. That's a good thing. The Rambam applauds me for that. Does that mean that I've got it all right, that I've emerged from the category of heretic? The Rambam would say no. So I think what's true for the Rambam plausibly could be true for the Ritva as well. All the Ritva says here is that they are heretics. It doesn't mean that it's not monotheism. Right? It's plausible that Islam is pure, 100% monotheism, but remains heretical nonetheless. I think
What's the status of a heretic in Judaism, then?
Mm-hmm. Great question. There are halachic ramifications to heresy. The question of who becomes a heretic is also a question, but there are ramifications. The slaughtering is disqualified. There are certain halachic implications of the status of a heretic. I wouldn't be able to write a Sefer Torah, wouldn't have sanctity. And the like, or tefillin, and mezuzah, and so on and so forth. There are certain halachic ramifications to what it means to be a heretic versus a non-heretical Jew. There is an additional debate, by the way, whether someone who comes to heretical beliefs by accident constitutes a heretic. The Rambam says either you have them or you don't. It's very hardcore about this. There are probably philosophical reasons for that. Others, such as Rabbi Yosef Albo, who lived already in the 15th century, says, no, we're not going to castigate as a heretic someone who tries to come to truth but comes to an incorrect conclusion. There are others who point out, they say, you know, in the 13th century, there were rabbis who believed that God had a body. It's true. It's true. We might think it's bizarre, it's absurd. These were not uncommon beliefs, especially in Ashkenaz. There's a reason the Rambam fought tooth and nail against these beliefs and denounced them as absurd and heretical and foolish, right? You only do that, right, with regard to beliefs that are
taking hold.
Right, that are somewhere taking hold. Otherwise, you don't bother going to war against the non-enemy, right? Once it's done, right? Now that the Reform and Orthodox movements are considered to be completely distinct, you don't regularly hear Orthodox rabbis railing against Reform because it's not the issue of our time. It's not a 21st century issue. They fought that in the 19th century. They fought that battle in the earlier parts of the 20th century. Been there, done that. And then with conservative, then that became the next, you know, and so on and so forth. So it's not necessarily the case that the fact that someone doesn't fight against something necessarily means that it's not so. But again, just to highlight the point, that the Ritva says that Islam is considered to be heretical is not the same as saying that they're not monotheistic, and that, again, heresy is a separate category in Jewish law. That's me, Emily. Curious. Yeah.
So is Reform and conservative Judaism considered heretical, or I know there are different perspectives, but does anybody go so far as to say that they're heretical?
In a strict sense, I'm not saying this in an emotional sense, but in a strict sense, I would say that it's clear that from an traditional Orthodox perspective, from a classic Orthodox perspective, Reform theology would be considered to be heretical, at least by the Rambam's 13 principles of faith. In other words, the mitzvot are no longer binding. That's a rejection of the Rambam's 8th principle of faith. So, without getting too emotional. Now, the question of accidental heresy and so on, that I think certainly feeds into the conversation. And do we go heresy hunting versus do we try to create positive, healthy, loving relationships even with people with whom we have fundamental disagreements? You know, that I think is an equally, if not more, important point to be made. But on a technical level, there is such an argument that would be made. Their conservative movement itself is a complex movement that itself has split and gone in different directions. You know, the liberal wing of the conservative movement increasingly is reminiscent of the wider liberal Jewish community. The old school conservative, you know, more traditional Jewish community is increasingly reminiscent, and many have actually started dominating at modern Orthodox synagogues. I remember when we were living in Englewood, there was a very prominent conservative halachic decisor who used to come and daven in the 9 a.m. auxiliary minyan in Avas Torah in Englewood every Shabbat morning. Because you know what? He didn't feel comfortable in the local conservative shul. So that was... And he didn't drive on Shabbat. So what was he to do?
Well, a generation ago, you know, while you graduates worked at, you know, conservative shuls that were... Yeah. Except for the fact there was no machitza and maybe a microphone, and not even always that. Other than that,
exactly. That's why I say, right, there's a historical piece to that, right? We see history moves quickly. 100%. Good. So that's the Ritva. Whether or not, we'll come back to the Ritva, though, in just a few minutes. So he might be unclear, but there are other sources that do seem to take seriously the unexpected possibility that Islam is idolatrous. So the Meiri, I mentioned the Meiri previously, Rabbi Menachem HaMeiri is writing in southern France in the 13th century for the most part, and he cites a view, a Sephardic view, that says exactly this. So first he says that this is from his commentary to Avodah Zarah in 57a, in Zayin Avod Aleph, Yishmaelim Halalu, Yesh Mi She'omer Alehem, there are those who say with regard to these Ishmaelites, She'enam, they're not idolatrous. He's writing in a Christian context. V'danim otam kiger toshav, they're treated like a ger toshav, who is this resident alien again, who essentially is someone who keeps the Noahide laws. V'ein maga'am voser bahanan. Again, following what we saw from the Rambam and that whole strand of thought, that their act of touching the wine does not prohibit it, at least from deriving benefit. It's only proscribed from drinking the wine per se. And then he says, "Mikol makom, nonetheless, chachmei svarad cholkim ba." The Sephardic rabbis, or at least some Sephardic rabbis, the Meiri says, disagree with this, and they maintain, Shaharet, that actually Islam is considered to be idolatrous. Shaharei matzinu b'ferek rishon, because we saw in the first chapter of Avodah Zarah, shehumone b'chlal avodot zarot gishra sheba'aravya, that the Gemara includes among examples of foreign worship, Gishra, a place. I'm not sure I didn't get a chance to look up where Gishra is, but Gesher in Hebrew is a bridge. I'm not sure if that's relevant or not. Gishra Shebe'aravya, this place, Gesher in Arabia. So these Sephardic scholars, and by the way, the Meiri rejects this as a matter of halacha, but he cites one of the authorities, or a cluster of Sephardic authoritative opinions, that maintain that the Gemara actually alludes to this by saying that there's a place called Gishra in Aravia, and that's included on the list of idolatry. So what do you see from there? What does that prove? That apparently Islam is considered Avodah Zarah. What's the historical argument against this? Right? When is the Talmud written? When is the Talmud edited? When is the Gemara completed? Okay, now, The latest scholars actually now put the final edits on the Talmud Bavli right around, many dated to right around the time of the rise of Islam. Mm-hmm. So 623, right around there, that's considered to be a real turning point. But it's fair to say with almost 100% confidence that historically it's extremely difficult to think that the Gemara referred in any way directly to Islam on purely historical grounds. So this reading of the Gemara, whatever the Gemara means to say, it's really, really going to be hard-pressed to say it's referring to Islam. So, and indeed, the overwhelming majority of commentators reject this reading of the Gemara. This is clearly a minority reading of the Gemara, and as we say, a difficult one as well. But there is this suggestion out there that, in Sfarad at least, that some think that it's idolatrous, which is unexpected. Because again, Islam seems to be even more purely monotheistic than is Judaism. But this is not the only view that we find along these lines. Take a look at the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim. Rabbeinu Nissim is also living in Barcelona, right around the time of the Ritva, maybe a drop later. And this is taken from his commentary to Masachet Sanhedrin. So he writes on Samach Aleph Amud Bet, Ramasko Yachol, V'lamadnu Mikan. We learn from here, Shehakodshim Shel Akum, that the sanctified items that belong to Gentiles, V'gam HaMeshuga, who can read the parentheses. Okay, they are living at times in which Jews are being terrorized by their neighbors. So that we have some context. Literally terrorized. These are horribly anti-Semitic contexts. So that's what we're describing here. So, right, using the same terminology as the Rambam. Afal pishi inam to'im acharihem la'asotam elokut. Although it's true that they do not err to make them into gods. What does he mean to say? Who's them or him? Into gods.
The icons, or whatever these holy
items. Right, the icons, right, these items, these kodshim, these sanctified items, right, again, they don't use icons in that way. Mikomakom nonetheless, look at this. This is really unusual. I had to read this a couple of times when I saw it the first time. Ho'il meshtachavim lefnehem ishtachava shel elakut. Since they bow before them, a bowing of godliness.
But they don't have images.
Strange. Din avodah zarah yesh lahem l'chol dvar isur shel avodah zarah. They have the laws of idolatry for all matters. And the commentators come along, they say, if it were true, maybe, but where do we ever see Muslims worshipping icons or worshipping with icons, Jerry?
I'm going to venture a guess here.
Yeah.
Since the Gemara was closed around the time that Islam was first starting out, virtually all of the Arabs who made up the first contingent of Muslims were idolaters themselves.
Okay.
Idolatry was an entrenched form of religion in Arabia at the time, and that's what Muhammad had.
Gishwa Shalarazia.
And Muhammad was known to be a master tactician in that he allowed certain customs of the original practice to be maintained for a certain period of time before you were expected to fully embrace Islam.
Good. So Jerry's status as the class historian comes to the rescue again. Thank you very much. 100%. We're going to see that this seems to have emerged, as good reason to think, from those earliest generations of Islam. So hold that thought. Very good. But we continue to see this line of thought in a contemporary decisor, the Tzitz Eliezer. Take a look on page 6 at the top.
Can I ask you, before we turn to this page, ask about the Me'iri? Because I'm really struck by the Me'iri, who we learned a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Was very nakil of Christians.
Yeah.
And his language here, even leaving the second piece out of Chachmei Sfarad, is very different with the Misha Omer. It's not as tolerant, and it seems to still question Islam, which to the Me'iri of all people, based on what he says, should be a more... by Christians should be more open and shut case.
Right.
Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I'd love to. The truth is that I only gave you a very small excerpt from the larger passage in the year. I don't think we'd have the same question if we read through the entire passage. It just goes on for quite some time, and I'm happy to share it with you or anyone else wants to see. But he just cites this, the Me'iri's whole styles, he cites a whole range of different sources. And he gives you a little bit from this, a little bit of that, and then ultimately he comes to his own view. So he's very comfortable citing others who maintain different opinions, and this is really him citing alternative positions. In the end of the day, he's very clear that Islam is considered to be not idolatrous.
So he comes out more consistent with his view on Christianity.
I think that's right, and especially given that his sort of is a compendium. That's how he wrote. I think that helps to address much. But it is a great point. Yeah. So the Tzitz Eliezer, so this is on the top of page 6, source 13, this is Chilak Yedal Tzimun Sadi Aleph, 1491. The Tzitz Eliezer was mentioned, for those who were here, when Dr. Reichman was here for Shabbat. He is he was best known as a scholar of medical ethics, and he was the postdoc of Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Yerushalayim. It's the only hospital that in the world, the best of my knowledge, I think, that purely follows halakha. Like they're 100% committed. Halakha is the binding criteria for all medical, not all medical decisions, but all questions that have to do with ethical and halachic matters. That's really the policy. So he was the postdoc for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, but he was an outstanding postdoc in a whole range, in a whole host of different areas, and so he addresses this question as well, and he actually unexpectedly comes out against Rav Avadia Yosef, or disagrees with Rav Avadia, and he says that, in fact, Islam is treated as idolatrous. Hare lamanim mifurash midivay ran, cites the Ran, Rabbi Nisim, that we just quoted, digam la'avodah yishmi ilim yishtach avayatam din avya sheker shalem din avodah elilim yish l'kat what we just saw. It said that icons are considered to be items of idolatry. The Imkim Barur Lefizeh, it's clear, says Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, the text Eliezer, Shigam Beit HaMiskad Shelahem, the mosque. He disagrees with Ravadi about the mosque. He says the mosque of the Muslims, Shibohim Ivatzim Avodatam, in which they carry out their service, Yesh Lo Gam Kin Din Shel Beit Avodat Elilim, that stands for Ayin Aleph Avodat Elilim, has the status of idolatry, idol worship, L'chol Davar, for all matters, Vasur L'Kan Yislisham. He says it's like a church, you can't enter a mosque. Says on the basis of the Ran, blessed be the God who gave us, separated us from those who are errants and gave us the true Torah. A very hard line. So we see in some that there are two major traditions in terms of Islam. And I want to make this, I think it's worth emphasizing, the overwhelming majority view and simple view, both, is that Islam, while heretical, is not idolatrous. That's very clear. Again, it's simple, it's just the Rambam and majority of Rishonim, etc. But there is a minority strand which we find cited in the Meiri, we find really from time to Gonim, and we find, and that's going to be important because of Jerry's point, and cited in the Ran, and then accepted it by at least one major posik against Rav Avadia and against that whole sort of thought that it is considered idolatrous, which again is very curious.
So when you go on Hajj to Mecca, Mecca is completely replete with icons. It's Avram's house, it's this, it's that.
Sure,
but all seem to be worship. That's what they go up there, you know, to worship.
But they don't, but in the actual place of worship and as part of the process of worship, they're extremely severe about this. In contemporary Islam, for a very long time, they're very strict halachot. They have sections of Sharia that outlaw praying to icons, and they're very...
And then how do you explain the whole Hajj, I think? It's like the
Right. I mean, how do you explain the Beit HaMikdash for a monotheistic faith? There is a real question there, but the idea is that there are icons that are separate from the act of worship that inspire our reverence, that draw a certain kind of connection, but that the act of worship itself is bereft of iconology.
And it's not like any figures, they don't have any...
Right, that's right, like as opposed to the pagan ones where you're actually, that's representative of life, right?
And in the pagan ones, we have the Kruvim.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which are
and there's a real. I mean, there's some question about this, and there's actually some extensive discussion. The Kuzari has a long discussion about this. Some say that really the Torah didn't want any of these things, but it had to wean us off, and so therefore it made certain sort of like what you said earlier that the Torah had an evolutionary rather than revolutionary educational sensibility about it.
And that's supposed to be the explanation for allowing us giving it to man's taifa for eating flesh. Because
to take it to vegetarian.
Right, Rabbanim saying that's the ideal existence.
The Rashba that we saw, he has a passage.
It's a concession to
you have to be very careful about where you quote that because some people don't want to hear it. Yes. Yes, slavery. Yeah. Some suggested with regard to slavery. The classic clear-cut instance that comes up first is with regard to the laws of Isha Yifat Tawar. Beginning of Parashat Ki Tetzeh, it talks about taking a female captive during time of the war and all sorts of things that we do there. And already the Midrash and Rashi cites it, the Gemara and Rashi cites it, say that Lo Dibra Torah El Keneged Yetzer Hara. The Torah was only dealing with the realities sort of on the ground. So again, we have these two streams of thought, and as opposed to Christianity, we can readily understand the difference of opinion. In Islam, it's more confusing. And indeed, there is a prominent line of thought that suggests something along the lines of exactly what Jerry had already said, that there is a historical component to this, and that in the earliest generations of Islam, actually, they were still weaning off, as it were, idolatrous practice, but that they were present for the first generations of Muslims. So, for example, Professor Mark Shapiro, who was here earlier this year, he wrote an article in 1993 entitled Misunderstanding Islam. And he goes through at least some of the materials I was talking about and some others. And he says as follows. He says, this did not always happen. In other words, the claim that Islam, or the position that Islam is not idolatrous, right, which he says is the majority and obvious position, which I think is right. And we therefore find a number of early references that characterize Islam as idolatrous due to the widespread mistaken perception that an idol, this is also true, that there were also misunderstandings in early Judaism about what was happening. Right? If we have that, we have that age of social media, we had that back in the 7th century as well. It just didn't know, and then from there, they just didn't know certain facts. And the perception that idols we found the Kaaba, the secret Islamic center of the worship in Mecca, there's even one medieval source that regards Mecca as the name of the Islamic idol. So there is a certain kind of a lack of clarity among the Jewish community just about what was actually happening. These mystical notions led some scholars to rule that it was forbidden to drink or even obtain benefit from wine handled by a Muslim because of the prohibition on drinking the wine of an idolater for fear that it was used for libations. So this is one. Maybe there were just mistaken assumptions within the Jewish community about Islamic practice. That's number one. Number two is the historical point, even that it might have even been accurately understood that at least in the earliest generations, the real basis for this belief that there were idolaters among the Muslims. Rav Avadia quotes this, based on the Rambam that we saw earlier. Nimsa, source 15, it's part of the, it's another excerpt from that same response in Rav Avadia Yosef. Nimsa shagonim harishon shamru sheish me'ilim of de'avadah zarahim. It emerges that the earlier geonim, and he says earlier, because the earliest of the Goanim were concurrent, essentially, with the rise of Islam, those first generations. So he says, we usually put the Goanim as roughly 700 to 1,000, or as late as 1,100. Right, but the 700, it's really, that those are rough estimates. It's really beginning. And the Goanic community is really a later continuation of the Babylonian quote-unquote Talmudic Jewish community. The same academies were still standing. So there was a Jewish presence there, an active Jewish presence there throughout the 7th century for sure. And we've actually lost a lot of those records. We don't really know very much about how the rise of Islam impacted on the local Jewish communities, at least from Jewish sources, which is very interesting. Turns out that the earlier Gaonim who claimed that the Yishmaelim, the Ishmaelites, were idolatrous, Havanatam al Yishmaelim derot rishonim, because they were talking about the initial Muslims, Sha'adayin hayu adu kimba v'dazara, exactly this, who were still clinging to idolatry. And Rav Avadia is using this in his argument to say that contemporary Islam is obviously not idolatrous. Or he's doing the opposite of the Tzitz Eliezer. Tzitz Eliezer says, you see from the Meiri, you see from the Ran, that actually it's idolatrous, you can't enter a mosque. Rav Avadia says, no, what you see from them is that the first generations might have been a problem. But that just proves the point. Proves the point that nowadays, everyone would agree, there's nothing idolatrous about Islam. Of course you can enter a mosque, as Rav Avadia takes Tzitz Eliezer, and he turns it on its head. It's the opposite view. Chumash Gazav HaRambam B'tshuva, and he quotes the Rambam in a tshuva. What's the Rambam in a tshuva? So I give that to you on top of page 7 from 369, easy to remember. Some good math there. Right. So the Rambam wrote the Emet. I don't know the significance of this. Actually, sounds more Trinitarian than Islamic or Jewish. But make of it as you will. The Emet. We don't know much about the Rambam's sense of humor, but there's reason to suspect that he had one. This might be an example. The Amet Shayal Yishmaelim, he called them Shlosha Minei Avodah Zarah. He says, even the Ishmaelites initially, says the Rambam, had three instances or types of Avodah Zarah, Pa'or, Umarkulis, V'chamosh, which were really biblical kinds of references. I'm not sure that the Rambam is historically accurate about this. The Rambam had many assumptions about earlier communities that weren't necessarily historically accurate in the Mor Nevuchim as well. But either way, the larger idea we now know is at least to some extent true. V'chulam mifurashim v'iduim mikodem shetamu da'ishmaelim. They were all prevalent prior, and presumably in the Arabian Peninsula, prior to the rise of Islam. V'hayom omrim ha'ishmaelim ki zeshan ha'shilich avanim. This is great. Nowadays, says the Rambam, I'm going to remember this around Rosh Hashanah, you'll see why in a moment, when we throw our stones, because they used to throw stones to these pagan gods, right? That's part of the worship of Markulis, specifically. We throw it not to our God, but rather to the Satan. Why? In order to confuse the Satan. Confuse the Satan. Anyone familiar with the Jewish argument that goes along these lines to confuse the Satan? Because we have this too. Hold that for a second. Shofar, I was thinking. Yeah. When specifically by shofar? One of the explanations for the month of Elul, and specifically for often it's brought. Why we stop the day on Erev Rosh Hashanah, many of the commentators say, well, that's to confuse the Satan. Right? And the Gemara also says, even earlier than that, the Gemara itself says that on Rosh Hashanah proper, sometimes we stand, sometimes we sit. It used to be that, now we stand for everything, typically. But it used to be that some were called the Tkiyot Me'uman, some were standing, and others were called Tkiyot Me'yusha, sitting Tkiyot, and that's in the Gemara. So the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Daf Tezayin says, why do they sometimes, were they blown, they're standing, they're blown, they're sitting, what's going on over here? So the Gemara has a very curious explanation. Everyone tries to understand what it could possibly mean. Can you arbe this Satan? It's to confuse the Satan. So I thought this is the most amazing thing, right? The Rambam is saying that the Ishmaelites had that too. They do it. Arbe this Satan. They throw, right? They throw the rocks. And suddenly it's like standing like, why are they throwing the rocks? This is bizarre. And meanwhile, they're like off and like worshiping their God. They get it done and they're out of there. Time he turns around, they're already finished prayer time. So that kind of thing. But you could probably ask the same question to them you ask about the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, right? Doesn't the Satan learn by the second or the third or the 103rd time? You ever wonder that? Like, what's the Satan like? He got like Ras Rosh Hashanah. We did the same thing. We stood and we sat. Like, how dumb is this satanic figure? He's not Milton Satan, that's for sure.
And also the custom among Hasidim, and it's spread into it's not getting more ready, but it's the custom of upshearing has a basis.
Some explain La Arbe Vesa Satan.
Right. So the idea was that if boys had grew their hair long,
mm-hmm.
It would confuse the Satan as to whether it's a boy or a girl. And therefore, once they get out of the danger years, because it was the infant mortality was, or you know, mortality at a young age was very very prevalent,
right?
Until modern times, so it was a way to increase the likelihood of survival from. You know, from the young age.
Interesting.
So it would confuse the Sultan because he couldn't figure out whether it was a boy or girl until they reached the safe age of three.
So that's very interesting. So without meaning to, God forbid, demean anyone who has the practice of performing an option for their children, especially who have Hasidic practices, etc., it would seem that the historical basis for the practice of cutting the hair was really because there was a widespread belief that Lilith, who was considered a female demon that was very frightening, would take away the children if they had long hair, would be, attracted by the hair, and then come and take them away. So it's actually, and then they would cut the hair in order to dissuade Lilith from coming and, God forbid, taking away the baby, snatching her. So that, there's some overlap. I wonder if there's any connection between sort of one
so
became the other.
The textual hook from Lilith, because that just seems like it's made out of whole
hair. Or do all these demons come from? There's a whole world of demonology that we don't really encounter in our world, but it's a whole, right. I want to say there's one biblical text where Lilith appears in maybe Eov. I want to say. There are a couple of others. Behemoth appears in Eov. Behemoth is, you see many references to these kinds of things. Even things that we don't consider to be, you know, demons nowadays were considered in biblical times to be references to demons. Sheol, we talk about, that's just Gehenna. Actually, it had a more specific understanding at that in that time.
What about Leviathan? Place.
Mavet, Leviathan is another one. Sure, Leviathan, absolutely. I think it's a pasuk in Eov, I'll double check. I think there's one reference in Tanakh. It's a hapex.
And Yom Kippur also have elements of confusing the Satan with the two Seth, the one that we push off the cliff.
Maybe I haven't seen the term Kedila Arbe Vesasatan there, but the Ramban the Ramban understands that there's actually some demonic force that we're actually really pacifying.
Right.
That's like more Zoharic. Like the Zohar says that you do Mayim Achronim at the table because you give it a gift, you give the Satan a gift, and then the Sitra Achra won't bother you during when you're trying to recite the blessing. But I think that's actually a genuine acceptance of a certain kind of lower power as opposed to not exactly, but you, my friend, are far from the only one. The last source, I cut it. It looks like it cut it up into two by accident. I don't know exactly what happened. I think the first one is just this is the one I added. So ignore the first one. We're not going to read it inside, but I gave it to you if anyone would like. This is an alternative view. So just to situate this both historically in context of our shiur, and this will be the last thing that we look at. This is a tshuva of the Radbaz, Rav David Ben Zimmer. Radbaz was also living in Cairo. He was the chief rabbi of Cairo about 200 years after the lifetime of the Rambam. That's Rav David Ben Zimra. He was a very influential and incredibly prolific author. In fact, on the Bar Ilan CD, he has the unique distinction of his tshuvos running so high that they go into the thousands, and they have to start renumbering them, because on the Bar Ilan CD, they don't really have a great way of accounting for the thousands. It's like when we count our years, and we say, this year is Tuf, Shin, Ayin, Zion. So if you do the Gematria, that's really 777. Of course, we know that on the Jewish calendar, this is not 777, this is 5777. So sometimes you'll see the hey added there. But what's going on? Other times you'll see lepei kuf. I don't know if you've ever seen that. That's leperek katan. Right? Perek katan means within a small chapter, quote unquote. In other words, within this millennium, right? That's what that is. So it's like the Jewish years traditionally didn't really allow for the thousands, so they just count by the hundreds. They figure you'd know whether you're in this millennium or not, right? Nowadays we follow the Gregorian calendar. I'm not sure that everyone necessarily would know, but that's... Anyhow, so the Radbaz is the unique distinction of being one of the few Shelot Tshuvot that actually goes in the thousands. So they just started adding Elef, which is a thousand. It's like, you know, instead of the hay before the year, have the aleph, as it were. So the Radbaz has a tshuva about martyrdom. Very practical, unfortunately, his time as well. He dealt with a lot of painful scenarios having to do with Islamic anti-Semitism. And I'll give it to you outside if anyone's interested. I'm happy to take anyone through, give a little bit more. But basically, he deals with the question, he was approached with the question of martyrdom. And you'll see how this fits in to the question of the status of Islam as idolatry in just a moment. So the Radbaz was asked, basically, do I have to give up my life in the case of Islam? The same question that the Rambam addressed that we mentioned at the beginning of this year, in his Igeret Hashma, the Rambam writing as a relatively young man, the Radbaz was asked the same question, and he takes the polar opposite view. The Radbaz insists that one must give up one's life rather than become a Muslim. He's extremely stringent with regard to this issue. He says many people did not do this. This was not what was going on. And again, he feels the need to write about it and write out against it because there was an issue on the table for his community. He says, this is terribly problematic. You'll ask me, it's not Avodah Zarah. So he says, you're right. It's not idolatry, but it is a different faith. It is a different faith. And we said before, it's heretical. So comes along to Radbaz and says that although it is true that from a Jewish perspective, Islam is not idolatrous, it is a different faith. The halakha is one must give up one's life rather than convert to a different faith. Call Christianity monotheistic if you want. I could care less. Call Islam monotheistic. I could care less. Nonetheless, one must give up one's life. And so this, I think, is a fascinating, not a, a sort of a middle position of sorts, but I think it really brings our conversation full circle. We've focused a lot of our attention on the question of, is Islam idolatrous or not? The majority position, yes. The minority position, right? Excuse me, the majority position is that it is not monotheistic. No, the minority position is that yes, and we were very curious, how could that be? How is that plausible? Is that just based on a mistake? Is that based on a historical, an ancient historical practice that doesn't really continue today? Comes along the Ranvaz and says it's a little bit more complicated than that. Because I can say that yes, they are purely monotheistic, but for the purposes of martyrdom, they are considered to be a different faith. And I think that's a very interesting, subtle, and sort of profound kind of position to maintain, that one can say that Islam or another faith community, that's a different religion. That's not what we do. And that is, they're such fundamental differences that I need to give up my life. But that doesn't mean that I'm calling it idolatrous. It's not Avodah Zarah. And nonetheless, it constitutes a different sort of faith community. So that completes our discussion of Islam. So we've seen Christianity, we've seen Islam, and we're about to do something that I have not embarked on ever, which is to undertake some sort of serious study of the Jewish approach to Eastern faiths. I've seen snippets here and there, but I haven't really looked into it. And I still haven't really looked into it yet, so I better get cracking, because I've got a week to do this.
There's a book called Jews and the Lotus.
Yes, I've heard of it, but I haven't read it.
So there might be some material.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Good. So I look forward to learning more myself about this. And next week is going to be the conclusion of this round of series. So we're going to be closing up there. As per our conversation, those who were here last week, I am looking pretty seriously at the possibility of doing topics related to medical ethics for next year. If there are specific areas in which you think I might benefit from learning, if you have professional expertise in this, if you know doctors in the community, I heard that there are a doctor or two in this community, so if you have a specific examples, I'm going to start asking around also for some concrete scenarios and issues that are on the table. These are some materials, I've dealt with this at Einstein, but it's been a couple of years since I delved back into these kinds of materials. I do so with some trepidation, because I don't have that level of expertise on that side, but I hope to consult with some people there in the community and otherwise. And I think it should be really, really fantastic. So if you have specific suggestions, I am all ears, as I start getting ready for next year's rounds of classes.
That'd be a great time.
Next week is the last one for the academic year, and then you have to wait until... the good news is, in the new school year, the good news is we've got tons of stuff up on the internet, on yutorah.org/Kohelet Yeshiva. And even better news is that, God willing, our new website will be up and running over the next X number of months, and we're going to have a whole Beit Midrash section. I'm very excited about it. And all the shiurim, the many shiurim will be available there, and we'll have video capacity and pictures and upcoming schedule and ways to get involved and interactive learning opportunities potentially. So really, the sky's the limit with that. I'm really excited about leveraging that to continue to build and grow. So. Exciting stuff. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Good. And again, if you want to...